Welcome to the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series created by Robert Jordan.
At its conclusion, the series will consist of 14 novels and one prequel novel.
Sadly, Robert Jordan did not live to see his work complete.
Brandon Sanderson, appointed by Mr. Jordan's widow, Harriet Rigney, will complete the series with the novels The Gathering Storm, Towers of Midnight, and A Memory of Light, based on the notes left by Mr. Jordan.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time. Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 63 of The Fourth Age, The Wheel of Time podcast, brought to you by DragonMount.com. I, of course, am Andrew Gellos, and with us this episode is Virginia.
Hi, everyone. Unfortunately, we have a somewhat diminished Virginia today. I have a head cold, so I'm going to try and work through it. And I apologize in advance for any odd-sounding voice or coughing that might make it through.
This episode, we will be continuing our ongoing multiple-part series, the recap of Knife of Dreams. And as such, there will be spoilers. We'll be discussing definitely Knife of Dreams, but we'll probably branch into almost any other book in the series as we discuss these events. So if you have not read through the Knife of Dreams, you may want to catch up to us a little later.
We're going to jump right into our recap, beginning with Chapter 18, entitled News for the Dragon. This one begins with Rand's point of view, and we find that Rand and Loial are finishing lunch at Lord Algarin's manor house. Lord Algarin himself has left for the Black Tower. It is pouring rain at the time. Loial continues to quiz Rand and take notes for his book, but he's disappointed because Rand does not elaborate on events like the fall of Ilion and the cleansing of the Source. Nynaeve and Alivia are there. Nynaeve still wears all of her jewelry to Rangreal's set, and her strange bracelet and rings Angreal. There are 50 maidens at the manor house, including some Shaido. Rand continually goes through the litany of women who died for him, and he wakes Min muttering the list at night. Rand's dementia is now so bad that Lutheran sometimes chants this list with him as well. Min is reading one of Herod Feld's books at the time. With Min, Elaine, and Avienda bonded to him, Rand wonders how to keep them safe. Varen and Cadswain are there, and Rand thinks of Matt and Perrin. He sees an image of Matt talking with a small dark woman and leading a line of folks through the forest. He also sees an image of Perrin with a man and a woman in uniforms. He can suppress the images if he wants, and he does so. He is angry because he needs them, and he thinks that they are off for a day at the Anseline Gardens. Another image forms, the stranger who saved his life at Shadar Logoth when he fought Samael. He and Lutheran both think that the man was aware of them, as if they were touching. Rand believes that their streams of Balefire crossing created a link of some sort between them. He knows the other man used the true power, so he must be a dark friend, but not one of the Forsaken, as Lutheran remembers all of their faces. Lutheran moans about the voice in his head and Ylenia. He wants to die to join her. Lanfear and Ishamael knew how to track Tavirin by their effects on the pattern, but no one else has found him that way since they died. Nynaeve delves Rand to make sure that she is okay. Many servants are sick because of the bad food spoiling all the time. She has no more success healing the wound in his side than Dahmer Flynn did. The servant Ethan enters and announces that Lord Loghain has returned. Loghain enters the room and reports on the status of Caemlyn, the Borderlanders, and the Black Tower. Aramilla still holds her siege on Elaine. Bashir has not returned yet. The Borderlanders have 13 Aes Sedai with them. Rand does not know what they want, but they have ties to the White Tower, and Elidas certainly still wants him. Following Rand's orders, Loghain sent Ashaman to Aradoban as well as Ilion, more than half the Black Tower, including all those bonded with Aes Sedai, except for the ones with Rand. Dobrain and Roark will send a messenger as soon as they find someone in charge in Aradoban or who knows where the king is. The Council of Merchants claim Al-Salam is still king, but no one can find him or produce him. Bandar Iban is in chaos. Rand will have to appoint a steward for Aradoman, but he does not know who. Taim is angry that Loghain took so many men with him and that he does not know where Rand is. There are 41 full Ashaman with Taim now, and 50 more in his special classes. Min still sees an aura of glory around Loghain. Rand cannot spend time worrying about Loghain and Taim because he has to deal with the Shan Shan and probably Tarmon Gaiden first. Rand and Loghain start arguing, and Cadswain tells them to be civil to one another. Varen pipes up that the signs indicate that the last battle is coming soon. Rand asks Cadswain what she thinks of his plan. She thinks that his peace with the Shan Shan will be very unpopular. He reminds her that it is just a truce and only with the dragon reborn, and that when he is gone they can start their war again. Cadswain is still doubtful. Rand tells her one of his answers from the Aelfin in the Twisted Red Doorway. When he asked how he can win the last battle, they answered, "The north and the east must be as one. The west and the south must be as one. The two must be as one." What he actually asked was how to win and survive, and the last part of his answer was, "To live, you must die." Rand thinks it means that he should let the Shan Chan hold the west and south and ally with them. Cadswain asks why, then, is he reinforcing Ilion and moving an army to Ariadoman. He wants armies in place to fight in case the Shan Chan will not agree to a truce. Rand has just figured out what the prophecies of the dragon meant with he must bind the Daughter of the Nine Moons to him. He expects Bashir to return soon with plans for their meeting. Cadswain tells him he must be flexible rather than hard. Ethan enters again and announces that three Ogier have arrived, including Loyal's mother, Kovril, daughter of Ella, daughter of Song. The other two must be Elderhaman and Aerith. Loyal is distraught, but Cadswain tells him to go see her. They are in the Ogier sitting room upstairs. Loyal is sure Aerith will take him back to Steading Sofu, so he will not be able to finish his book. Loyal reluctantly leaves to go see them. Varen goes to find Tomas, and Nynaeve goes to find Lan. The storm outside is letting up, but Nynaeve says a terrible storm is still coming.
One of the first things that really strikes me in this particular chapter is when Rand gets a bleed-through of information from Luce Thurin, when he is thinking that, you know, he really needs Matt and Perrin, but they're off for a day at the Onseline Gardens. And he later notes that, you know, Luce Thurin has started remembering things from the Two Rivers, so that the two of them seem to be kind of merging together. And just, for some reason, that's amazingly creepy when you can't even rely on your own memories anymore to be separate from the other sets of memories in your head.
Yeah, it's just one more thing that poor Rand's got going on with all the things going on in his head and the bonds and links and so forth. I don't know how he even functions, to be honest with you.
I kind of also find it a little ironic that the memory happened to involve the Onseline Gardens, where the Forsaken Tea Party was taking place, you know, either at another point in time or at that moment, you know, as they sit in the world. I don't know exactly where the two events meet in the chronology of the book.
Yeah, that is kind of weird when you think about it. They're not too far apart, this whole chapter at the gardens, and then, you know, we presume that this is a fairly similar time, so it would be really eerie if it actually had been meant to be at the same time, or very close to the same time. I kind of wonder about this tracking of Tavirin thing. It seems that really only Eshamiel and Lanfear were any good at doing it. I know in one of the more recent chapters, Semrog said it was, I believe it was Semrog or Grendel, one of the two said it was not all that easy to do, especially now that the pattern was in such flux.
That makes me wonder, though. I wonder if Robert Jordan had always planned it that way, because we do know that really it was Lanfear and Eshamiel who really latched on to the three boys and would constantly appear in their dreams and other sorts of stuff like that, and the others really didn't do that, and I'm now not wondering if it's because they, above the rest of the Forsaken, had this ability to track the Tavirin, and that's why they were able to find them so often and so readily.
Yeah, I think you're probably right about that. I think if the others could have done, they would have. But everybody has kind of said that Lanfear's powers in the world of dreams and in dreaming are probably stronger than almost anybody's, and we presume that Eshamiel's were pretty strong as well. But then, you know, Mogedion had quite a lot of talent there, and she didn't really do a lot of that. She appeared in Teleronriad a lot, but she didn't really try and touch their dreams very often or anything that we know of.
Very true. Another thing that was really interesting is that we get in this chapter again that, as we mentioned in the last podcast, that Rand, in order to still the chaos in the Ariadoman, has sent the Goshin and several other of his forces into the Ariadoman. It's also very nice to know that, you know, he has them there for the secondary reason that if the Shanshan decide to refuse his treaty to be allies, that he wants to have a massive strike force there in order to be able to counter them if, you know, conflict should happen to break out, which is really neat.
Yeah, I kind of love that attitude. Be my friend or I'll kill you. Yeah, that's just sort of no middle of the road there.
The enemy of my enemy can still hold a knife to my throat and claim to be my friend.
Yeah. I really think one of the most interesting things in this chapter is the vision of, we presume it's Moradin, that he has, and the fact that he and Lucetheryn both think that the man was aware of them. That, to me, is very creepy, and it sort of confirms one of my crazy theories that at some point in time there will be a merging not only of Rand and Lucetheryn, but possibly with Moradin as well.
True. And then, you know, whoever emerges out of the end of it, it is the final phase, you know, maybe that has something to do with, you know, Rand living and dying and, you know, possibly living again, or however they want to end up resolving the entire issue of to live, you must die.
Well, I really don't know why there's so much controversy about it, because to me it seems pretty obvious that there is in some fashion he's going to die and then be either returned to life or reborn in some way, such as that it won't be a true death. But then I've been just crashingly spectacularly wrong before, so I got to thinking about it the other day, and going back to, you know, Jason's reading of the prologue, actually the whole book, The Gathering Storm, and he mentions that there's some really critical, unbelievable thing that happens to Rand, something that he does, and I just sort of wonder if he doesn't. I mean, wouldn't it be just beyond creepy? I mean, we've been cheering for Rand all the time, and we think he's like the ultimate good guy, but wouldn't it just be unbelievably plot-twisty that he would just become evil and just turn, if you will, to the dark side and say, well, like Dr. Horrible, it's a brand new day. Guess what? You're all dying.
Be interesting. I would kind of hope not, but yeah, it would be a wonderful twist, you know, something that would be a little less expected out of your traditional story progression in your epic fantasy, where, you know, your hero suddenly turns out to not really be your hero when you know, least suspect it. Of course, I am really happy that we got at least one of the answers from the Aelfin in this chapter as well. We, of course, always get all of Matt's answers, because he's the most prominently focused when we visit the Finns, but it was really interesting when you get these tidbits from other people, and I'm kind of hoping that we'll end up getting the questions and answers from the Finns for Moraine in at least one of the last three books.
Good point. Yeah, I just sort of wonder then if that leaves the door open for Narishma to be the one who comes after, because he drew the sword from the heart of the stone. Because obviously if Rand just decides that in order to be hard enough to win, he's got to become as evil as the evil ones, then it's not going to be the good guy anymore.
So do you think Rand has it right with his interpretation of the North and East must be as one, the South, or West and South must be as one, and the two must be as one?
I don't know. I've given that a lot of thought, and I really think that his interpretation is probably too literal and too easy. I think the Finn speak in a lot more convoluted way than that, and it would not surprise me at all if there was something much deeper and less obvious to that. I think that just taking, you know, parts of the continent as the North and the East must be as one might just be too superficial. And the last part, to live you must die, that's obviously slightly metaphorical, or maybe it's literal truth if he actually does die and is healed from death. I mean, obviously there's been a lot of speculation that Nynaeve will be able to do that. She healed Stilling, which everybody said nobody could do, so obviously the next possible hurdle for her to overcome would be healing death.
I don't wonder if there's a possibility, because the more I think about it, if you are drawing out the lines and circling in the areas, you know, the North and the East and the West and the South, it kind of makes, you know, the ancient symbol of the Aes Sedai, where, you know, if you kind of get the North and the East connected in one section and the South and the West connected in one section in a giant circle, it ends up being kind of that same, you know, sinuous shape.
Well, that's just too creepy for words.
About the only other thing that I noticed in this chapter, of course, is the news that Loial's mother has now finally caught up to him. And she has in tow two others, which of course Loial guesses correctly are Elder Haman and Aerith. And it was kind of neat to see him looking for any sort of avenue, and Kutswana is like, nope. No, go now.
Dun, 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 dun. He's even willing to haul an Aes Sedai along with him for protection.
Yeah. It's also kind of interesting that at this point, Varen and Nynaeve both leave to go find their respective warders, which prompts, of course, in the next chapter, both of them leaving.
Yeah, except technically Lan is not Nynaeve's warder, just her husband. I know.
Yeah, but he's been bound to act as her warder.
Yeah, technically he's still Morel's. She's never released him.
And of course, actually, I am incorrect. It is not in the next chapter that they both leave, but it is where they go to get Tomas and Lan in preparation for their later leaving in the book.
Scary. I don't know where they're going. I just think it's interesting how detailed these color swirling visions of the three Tavaren are. You know, I mean, they can actually see exactly what they're doing right that minute, and apparently Rand can actually see the other two at the same time, both of them, like stereo, kind of.
Yeah, well, I kind of wonder if Matt and Perrin have ever tried thinking about both of the other ones at the same time. I mean, I don't really remember. It usually seems like they just kind of idly think about one or the other. I think this is the first chance that we've actually seen where someone's thinking about both of them at the same time. I find it very amazing at how often people, or you know, one of them sees Matt and he's talking to or riding with Tuan, and or riding through a forest, and how often, you know, Perrin is seen talking to other people. But almost every time that Matt or Perrin thinks of Rand and that, he's like
with Min.
I mean, just that's a lot more naked Rand than I need to see in my head.
I guess it's a lot more than they needed to see either. Matt wasn't all that thrilled about it. But I don't know, I guess it's just indicative of the fact that he's spending a lot of his free time that way. I wonder how long it's going to be before the boys think of using this color-swirling, peeping Tomery to communicate with each other, or at least try. I mean, none of them have tried to, you know, actually do anything other than view these things, and usually they don't even want to do that. They just bat them away or smash them or whatever. But if they would actually become participatory, maybe they could communicate, which would be really helpful.
Just always carry around a sign. Matt, think about me in approximately 2 minutes. Let's see if we can work this out. Rand.
Well, I mean, you know, it just because he's viewing them doesn't mean that he can't maybe somehow get their attention if they've tried. They haven't tried, so how do they know? It's better than a cell phone.
I mean, at least it could end up being useful if one of the others does end up getting, like, captured or something, and it's like, hey, I actually kind of recognize where that is. I can actually do something about this.
Yeah, it's sort of making me think of that Stargate Atlantis episode that you mentioned last week with Rodney having the other consciousness in his head. Oh yeah, turn here, no, turn there. Wait a minute, no, I'm confused. Don't, no, go straight. Oh wait, the guards are coming right now. Don't, no, do this. I'm not crazy, I just have another consciousness in my head.
I just love the matter-of-fact the way he said it. I'm not crazy, I just have another consciousness in my brain.
It's not that difficult to understand.
I kind of also wonder if the storm that Nynaeve is sensing might not end up being connected to the storm for which the next, or the upcoming gathering storm is named.
Well, I think so. Well, I think we've probably explored everything in this chapter now. Let's move on to chapter 19.
Chapter 19, entitled Vowels, is from Loial's point of view. Loial, of course, is too nervous to ask Nynaeve or Varen to accompany him. He makes note because he runs into several servants who are telling stories of having seen ghosts in the hallways, and he is as yet unable to see human ghosts. He hasn't seen any Ogier ghosts either. Varen seems to know a great deal about these recent effects, though. From the hallway, he goes upstairs to the Ogier quarters. He thinks it's a little odd that Cadswain seems to know his mother. His mother, of course, is waiting with Elder Haman and Aerith in a sitting room. Loial thinks, of course, that Aerith is beautiful, and it's very obvious that he's smitten with her. Corvril and Haman are angry that they have had such a long and arduous journey in trying to find him. They traveled to Kyrian, from Kyrian to Setting Sofu, from Setting Sofu to Camelin, from Camelin to the Two Rivers, from the Two Rivers back to Camelin, and then back to Kyrian. And finally, Corvril has decided that she spent far too much time away and that she needs to return to the Great Stump. And they were headed on their way back to Setting Shangti, and I guess just happened to stumble upon Loial along the way, as they just stopped at the manor house in order to take a quick break before continuing on. Aerith notes that Loial was very heroic in closing the Manetherin way gate with Gaul at Emmons Field, and for rescuing Rand at Dumai's Wells. You know, following some exchanges, Elder Haman fulfills the agreement made between Corvril and Aerith's parents, and Loial and Aerith are married. They, of course, rub noses in the Ogier fashion for a minute. Corvril wants, of course, to immediately leave for Setting Shangti, but Elder Haman insists on staying the night. It turns out that the Great Stump is debating opening the Book of Translation, which is supposed to take the Ogier into another world. Loial thinks this is a bad idea and wishes that he could address the Great Stump and argue that the Ogier should stay and fight the Shadow as they did during the Trolloc Wars. As he's making his case to address the Stump, he happens to look out the window and sees an army of Trollocs advancing. He and Elder Haman pick up axes, while Aerith and Corvril pick up long knives, which are suited for Ogier gardeners, and they go to warn Rand. From at this point, the point of view shifts to Rand. He and Consuane both detect the Shadow Spawn approaching and get ready for battle. Loghain, Olivia, and Min are also there. They hear the Ogier shouting, and they take up places at the windows. At the window, Rand sees the army of Trollocs being led by Murdrel. Bashir's Saldaeans are trapped in the outbuildings. Rand seizes Sidene, but when the dizziness hits him, Luis Thuren jumps in and steals control away from him. He can see, through his enhanced eyesight, pins identifying the Afreet, the Kobol, the Gremlin, the Agol, the Daemon, the Davol, the Gargel, the Dijenen, the Bonsheen, and some of the other and lesser recognizable bands of Trollocs. Luis Thuren howls because he desires to channel and kill them all. But he cannot move his hands until Rand relinquishes the use of them. Luis Thuren channels air, earth, and fire in blossoms of fire. He weaves spirit touched with fire for gateways, but then adds touches of earth, which changes them into death gates. It is here that we learn that traveling actually kills Shadow Spawn, which is why they've been using the ways instead of just stepping through gateways. Rand raises his hands so that he can see them, and Luis Thuren weaves fire and earth for arrows of fire. The Trollocs try to break into the outbuildings, and some of them end up catching on fire. Loghain quenches the fires. Luis Thuren is only focused through the whole battle on killing. He doesn't stop to worry about any allies that Rand has or anything else, but making certain the Shadow Spawn die. Eventually, all of the Trollocs lie dead. Loghain releases Sidene and asks why Rand didn't teach him these fancy new weaves sooner. He wonders if he might not be playing favorites like Taim. Luis Thuren, unfortunately, will not release Sidene. He moans that he wants to join Elenya. Luis Thuren remembers, at this point, dying, and how he created Dragon Mount, and starts the process again, drawing too much of Sidene. Loghain notices this, and makes a note out loud. At this point, everyone is very concerned, and Kotsuane grills Min, knowing of her bond to him, asking how Rand is feeling, because Rand warns Kotsuane not to threaten Min, and tells Luce Thurin that they can die together at Tarmangaiden, if he will only release the source now, and Luce Thurin reluctantly agrees. Kotsuane knows this, of course, before Loghain tells her.
Well, I think it's interesting that one of the things that Loial was fearing the most, the wedding to Aerith, just comes and goes, you know, in typical Robert Jordan fashion, in the space of a few paragraphs. And is sort of anticlimactic in a way. And turns out that, you know, she's very smitten with him and will probably let him do just about anything he wants to, it seems to me. She's very proud of him, that he's brave, and that the Aiel spoke highly of his heroics, and so forth and so on. So I think that he's not going to have as difficult a time going off to finish his book as he might think.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, she kind of argues for him first before he actually takes up the argument that, you know, he should address the stump and try to convince the Ogier to stay and fight.
Yeah, it's funny, too, because she's so meek, you know, the whole time that we've ever seen her. She's just as, you know, mild as milk water, as the saying goes. And yet, the minute she's married, she stands right up to Mother Colville and says, "Will you allow me to tend my own husband, Mother Colville?" You know, he wants to grow mustaches and a beard, and he should grow mustaches and a beard. He wants to address the great stump. Well, that's the right of a husband to do so. So, there you go.
And she does. She kind of hops on, you know, Loial's mother. He just kind of, you know, hopping in there like, you know, well, no. You've mothered him far too much. You know, he's mine now.
Yep, that's it. Mine now. The other thing I thought was kind of interesting, well, there were a number of really interesting things in this chapter. The entire battle with the Trollocs and the Myrdal is fascinating in a lot of respects to me, but one of the things that caught my attention was the names of the Trolloc bands have always kind of tweaked my imagination a little bit. They're very similar to names for demons and other similar spirits in our nomenclature of this day. The Ifrit, I think, would be like the, you know, the Ifrit, the genies in the bottle sort of things. The Gremlin is obviously an adaptation of Gremlin. Algol is actually an Arabic word that means demon, and there's a star named Algol, which is called the Demon Star. And Diamond is obviously demon. Gargale would be gargoyle. Jinnin would be the jinn. Banshin would be the banshees of Irish legend, and it goes on and on. I just think it's really kind of amazing how many cultural crossovers Robert Jordan manages to weave into these books, just almost as an aside.
Yeah, the kobold being the kobold, and the davol being the devil, and it is. It's really interesting, and I like the fact that in this particular attack, which I firmly now do believe is the attack mentioned in the earlier chapter at the gardens, he seems to use like almost all of the 13 tribes of Trollocs.
Yeah, another interesting thing are these new weaves that comes up. We've actually seen the Arrows of Fire before, during one of Rand's battles with the Forsaken and Teleronriad, but the Blossoms of Fire and the Death Gates are new, and of course Loghain is a little bit miffed, you know, that he hasn't been taught these weaves, and he's basically accusing Rand of acting like Mazrim Taim and keeping special weaves just for his favorites. It's kind of interesting, the byplay that starts now that Loghain is with Rand. And I'm going to trot out my pet theory again, but in support of that, Rand even mentions that in his point of view, in his mind, he thinks to himself that, well, Loghain seems all right, but there's a darkness to him. So the jury's still out in my mind on that.
Yeah. I mean, I like the irony, of course, that, you know, Rand didn't remember that he knew these weaves until Luce Thurin did them. So it's one of those just neat little things. I also kind of liked the literary out that Robert Jordan used in creating the Death Gates. That the idea that, you know, well, why haven't we just seen the Forsaken, you know, open up a gateway and pour thousands of Trollocs into any city that they wanted? Well, you know, there has to be a reason, you know, why are they not just overrunning the place with Trolloc attacks? Well, it turns out that traveling kills Shadowspawn, and you know, so therefore, you know, how do you use that as a, in a way that you know, could be used offensively. Well, you find a way for the gateways to kind of become, you know, giant flying Pac-Men.
Yeah, these gates are like opening and closing, evidently moving at the same time, not staying stationary. I really do think you're right about that, though. He had to come up with something to explain the fact that the Forsaken never just used gateways to dump thousands and thousands of Trollocs any place they felt like it.
One of the things I was really happy about in this episode, too, is that we got Elder Haman. I mean, we have heard so much about him, and it was just, you know, suddenly, you know, there he is, and of course, you know, the instant they find out about the Trollocs, you know, he's right there in the, you know, implacable Ogier fashion, you know, hefting up the wood axe. Yeah, you know, that is definitely, it's supposed to look ornamental, but at the same time, you can kind of tell it was supposed to be, you know, a ceremonial weapon for the Ogier, and him picking it up, and just that stern with the ears lying flat back, and they're just like, oh yeah. He very obviously doesn't let himself be cowed by Korvril either. Even though she's a great speaker, he still is an elder, and, you know, is due his respect.
Yeah, it sort of reinforces the feeling that I've had for quite some time that I don't want to see an irate Ogier under any circumstances, armed or not.
I will say, of course, that when reading this with my wife out loud, Elder Haman posed a challenge because it is easy enough to adapt my voice to sound like what I think Loial sounds like, but the rest of the Ogier all seem to me in my mind, at least the men, seem to be bigger and older, and therefore their voices need to be at octaves I just sometimes have troubles reaching.
Yeah, I can imagine. I think that one of the other interesting little byplays that comes along in this chapter is that finally Rand is trying to convince Lucerne to release the source, and basically promises them that they can die together at Ptarmigan, and then Lucerne releases the source. And I mean, how creepy is it that he sits there and goes, I remember how I died, and starts to do it, just draws more and more of the power until Rand's feeling the prickling pain and the heat and everything of it. And I think that's kind of eerie in a way.
Oh, yeah. I mean, just the comment, I remember how I died. I remember doing it. You know, just...
Want to see it.
It is very... Well, and moreover than that, it was the idea that for the first time we do get that kind of sense that maybe Rand really isn't all that crazy, or maybe Lucerne actually is a separate entity in Rand's head, you know, because, you know, Rand goes to channel and, you know, and then suddenly he's not in control of it anymore, and, you know, the other personality in his brain is.
Well, I've sort of been of the opinion for a long time that they were two separate entities, basically two consciousnesses in one body, because... Well, look at the weaves. You know, Rand didn't know these weaves until he saw Lucerne do them. You know, and he was able to imitate them and kind of, quote-unquote, remember them. But he never knew them. He didn't know how to do Death Gates or Blossoms of Fire or any of that stuff. He learned when he saw Lucerne do it. Lucerne is a completely separate entity. He had different ways of discussing things and terminologies and everything. He thinks that, you know, Lucerne thinks of spinning a web, whereas Rand thinks of weaving flows. You know, and they think of things differently, and Rand never knows these until Lucerne thinks them. We presume vice versa as well. So that's one of the reasons why I don't think that it's going to be necessary for them to reintegrate per se. I think that if anybody reintegrates, it may end up being Lucerne and Morden. I don't know. And then, you know, or one of them and both of them, or both of them will die and Rand will live, or they'll all die and only Rand's consciousness will be reborn or healed from death.
True. I also think, and it goes back to the previous chapter, that it was really ironic that both Rand and Lucerne don't think about the fact that the Forsaken don't really stay dead. And the idea that neither of them connect Moradin with Shamael. Like, they completely miss that particular point. They're like, well, you know, Ishamael and Lanfear used to track me, but they're both dead, so, you know, well, I guess not.
The famous not dead or not dead for long, forsaken, recycled, reconstituted, and just as bad as ever, except for Sindane, of course. Do you have anything else?
So creepy. I named one of my final fantasy characters Sindane at one point in time before that character ever appeared in the Wheel of Time series. Spelled the same, too.
Ooh, did she have silver hair?
Actually, it was a guy.
All right, well, that actually happens here, too, but not with Lanfear and Sindane. That's kind of scary. Well, moving right along to the next chapter, Chapter 20, The Golden Crane.
We continue with Rand's point of view. He and his group have gone outside of Lord Algarin's manor, and Rand is surveying the mess of dead Trollocs and Murdrel with Loghain, Godswain, Olivia, Min, and the Ashaman and Aes Sedai, along with the surviving Saldaeans. Nandarin leads the 50 maidens that are with him. Loghain, of course, has an umbrella of air woven to ward off the rain, but Rand is too afraid that Luce Thurin will try to take over again if he attempts any weaves. They, of course, at this point, because of the massive amounts of dead, have all but given up trying to kill the crows and ravens that have come to feast on the corpses. Loghain says Gabrel and Tovin have worn themselves out from channeling. Fewer than 12 Ashaman and fewer than 20 Aes Sedai are working, of course, to incinerate the thousands of carrion that they find. They think that the Trollocs came from the spine of the world through the waygate at Steading Shangti. Rand thinks that someone knows Ashamael's trick of tracking Taverin, or maybe the blue-eyed man can locate him. The true source, of course, is now clean, but with the wound in his side from Ashamael and Padan Fain, Rand wonders if he is clean. A serving man, even older than Ethan, brings Rand a letter from Varin. Amongst their countings, there are 19 dead Saldaeans, and they're laid out in a barn because the Saldaean tradition is to not bury their dead in the rain. Suddenly, however, they become covered in flies. Olivia creates a weave that sends all of the flies out of the door. Kutswane notes, of course, that the former Demone learns incredibly fast. Min is, of course, very concerned for Rand, and thinks how sad it is that he cannot hope to win without the help of a woman who is dead. She thinks that it is odd that Moraine was the only viewing that she had ever been wrong about, and that she had to have been wrong because Moraine is dead. Rand reads Varin's letter. It turns out that she has left, taking Tomas with her, but she does not say where she is going or when she will be back, if she will. She says that Rand should trust Cadswain and heed her advice, but to be wary of everyone else. Loial and Elder Haman come outside. Loial tells Rand the news that he and Aerith are married, and Rand congratulates him as best he can. Loial promises that he will be there for Rand at Tarmon Gaiden. Rand has sealed the way gates at Camelin, Kyrian, Ilion, and Tyr, and he has put a trap on the open way gate near Faldara. But he could not find the one near Farmadding. He presses Loial to locate and close the remaining way gates. Elder Haman, at this point, insists that Loial must return to Steading Shangti and speak at the Great Stump in order to convince the Ogier to stay and aid Rand in the last battle. But he volunteers to take up the task himself. Rand says that he will take them all to Steading Shangti in the morning. Elza Penfell arrives with Davram Bashair. Bashair and Carlden Manfor met with High Lady Seroth. They were not allowed to talk with anyone other than Seroth. The Daughter of the Nine Moons apparently will meet Rand at a manor house in northern Altara. She will bring 6 Suldam and Damane and no one else. Rand will then be allowed to bring 5 other channelers and 1 other woman to make the numbers even. From here, the point of view shifts to Nynaeve, who is resting from channeling too much. She's taken willow bark for her headache, but of course, as with everything, it's not working amazingly well. She, of course, is still wearing her bracelet and rings Ongreal and the jewelry set of Tur Ongreal. One of her rings, the one with the pale green stone, detects the use of Sadar and Sadin. Another, with a flawless sapphire, turns cold when somebody or someone nearby her is hostile or angry. Lana's, of course, with her. It still grates at Nynaeve that Mirel holds his bond, and she plans, of course, to get the bond from her as soon as she is able to. Outside, she sees Aisling Noon bonded to Arel Maelvin, and Ayako Norsoni, who is bonded to Donalo Sondamir. She, of course, avoids these other Aes Sedai because they are supporters of Elida. They are linked in pairs, using both Sidar and Sadin to incinerate the corpses. Lan is angry that Rand is negotiating with the Seanchan instead of convincing King Aesar to return to the Blight. As he rightly points out, the last battle will be there and at Shai al-Ghul, and having the borderland rulers in the south makes absolutely no sense. He recounts that during the Trolloc Wars, the Shadow used Tarwyn's Gap to move large armies of Trollocs south. Nynaeve, seeing his frustration, offers to take him to the borderlands to allow him to ride into battle, as he sees that he must. But first, she makes him swear that he will ride to Fal Mouron before he enters the Blight, and that he will allow anyone who wishes to ride with him to do so. He agrees, and they go to the stables to mount up. Outside, she weaves a gateway, and they lead the horses through. It is only at this point, once they have gone through the gateway, and Nynaeve has already created a new gateway to another location, that Lan realizes that they aren't in Shinar at all. She has taken them to World's End, which is in Saldea, as far from Fal Mouron as is possible to go in the Borderlands. Nynaeve, of course, reminds him of his oath that he must do as he has promised and ride to Fal Mouron and allow anyone who wants to ride with him, and then hurriedly rides through her new gateway and lets it close before he can do anything about it. The point of view then shifts to Waelen Aldragoran, who is a jewel merchant. He deals jewels in the common room of the Queen's Lands in Kayakun in western Saldea. Though he has lived almost his whole life in Saldea, he is of Malkyrie descent and still wears his Hadori. His wife, Alida Aldragoran, is Saldean. Mongon and Goranellan are also jewel merchants of Malkyrie heritage, though they don't wear the Hadori. He is currently selling jewels to two Ilianners. A very young Aes Sedai approaches him, and she happens to be wearing the red kisane of a Malkyrie wife. He finds that odd because few Malkyrie go to the White Tower, since the Aes Sedai failed Malkyr and allowed it to fall. The young Aes Sedai asks him to send messages to other merchants with his pigeons. She shows him Lan's ring and identifies herself as Nynaeve T. Almara Mondragoran. The message is this: Lan Mondragoran rides from World's End to Tarwyn's Gap toward Tarmin Gaiden. Will he ride alone? Aldragoran swears that he will ride with Lan. She leaves, saying that she has more towns to visit before returning to Tyr that night, which, of course, thoroughly astounds Waelen. The other two Malkyrie, Mongon and Gornellan, join his oath, shouting, "The Golden Crane flies for Tarmin Gaiden."
There's a lot going on in that chapter, I'll tell you.
Yeah, I really like this chapter, because it is one of those moments, as I've commented, that And then she has a really big moment where she's really, really awesome. And, you know, I've kind of wondered if she has a finite number of awesomeness or not.
No, she has infinite awesomeness.
Of course, earlier in the chapter, of course, we do get Varen and her mysterious disappearance. We've presumed in previous podcasts that she has gone to retrieve the Horn of Valir, having seen enough portents of Tarman Gaiden that it is necessary to retrieve it if Rand is to have it for the last battle.
Well, actually, if Matt's going to have it for the last battle.
True. One implying the other. It is interesting to note that she says that Rand should trust Cadswain, but to be wary of anyone else. And I think this might be a little bit of evidence for our relative theory that Varen might in fact not be Black Aja, but might in fact be Purple or Plaid.
Or some other hidden Aja that we know nothing about.
Yes, the uber light friends.
Yes, exactly. I'd rather subscribe to that point of view myself. I think she's bound to some of the oaths, but probably not all of them.
I think the reason that I want to believe this, and why I like this as evidence for it, is that we have had points of view from Cadswain, in which Cadswain thinks about the fact that she nearly had rooted out the Black Aja. And, you know, her points of view seem, at least to me, to convince me that she is not Black herself, because I think that if she were Black, she would think, like, you know, in terms of, oh, well, I'm a dark friend. And, you know, none of the things that she thinks, in my mind, could be picked out as actually indicating that she has even tendencies toward the leanings, towards the dark one. And if Varen trusts her enough, or trust her with Rand and giving Rand advice, then I can't believe that Varen could be a dark friend. Now, I might be horribly wrong, and it just wouldn't make any sense to me that, you know, here, trust my hated enemy, because it'll help me somehow.
Well, I've said from the first that, you know, that one point of view where Cadswain reflects that she almost had rooted out the Black Aja just indicated to me that she wasn't Black Aja too, because nobody, I mean, even people that delude themselves don't normally speak of themselves in their minds as completely opposite to what they are. Nobody's really that, you know, insane, usually. So now we've got Rand moving all these armies to Ar-Adamon, and now we've got the Golden Crane flying for Tarman Gaiden, and presumably heading toward Tarwin's Gap, which isn't all that close to Ar-Adamon. But how are these disparate armies going to link up to fight the last battle at some point?
Well, if I'm right about about Ar-Adamon being a massive staging ground to move all of the armies that will be, hopefully, in Rand's Grand Alliance to Sheol Ghul, then hopefully it'll be one of those things that, you know, Lan's armies are kind of pushing and maybe fighting a desperate battle, you know, at Tarwin's Gap, or even a little further north or a little further south, you know, and suddenly the Trolloc army is breaking in order to ride back, because suddenly Rand's massive army has shown up at Sheol Ghul completely outside of the realm of the expected. And, you know, that allows, you know, Lan to come in and, you know, be the hammer against the anvil, to pick up a phrase used in New Spring.
What do you think of these messages that Nynaeve sent through the pigeons of the merchant? Do you think they're actually going to make it to where they're going? Do you think it's going to do any good?
I think it has to. I think it would be really, really sad if Lan shows up at Tarwin's Gap with those three Malkyrie.
Yeah. That'll be like Egwene with, you know, Lelaine and Ramonda basically left standing against Elaina at the White Tower.
Yeah, I kind of think that it really depends. We know that 20 years ago from New Spring that there were already a grand host of Malkyrie ready to fly to the Golden Crane when Aiden Arell raised the banner in Lon's name.
That's true. It seems like there'll be plenty of them. He's certainly met and the people that would have ridden with him had they, you know, had the opportunity. There are plenty of the Saldans would have when they were in Saldaea, you know, the end of the Eye of the World and the Great Hunt. I would have to say that the star of this chapter had to have been Nynaeve.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, it was such an Aes Sedai moment as well for her to kind of, you know, in a way extort those oaths from Lon that, you know, he would ride to Val Moran and he would let anybody who decided to ride with him do so before she took him where he went. And then, of course, you know, the gift an Aes Sedai gives you isn't always the gift you think it is, and turns out that she puts him as far away from his objective as he possibly could be. That way he has the most chance of gathering the army together. And then, you know, not leaving it to chance at all, she then, of course, goes and seeks out, you know, any sorts of, or any amount of people that she could, who could send on messages to the other Mulciri. You know, it seeks them out and actually goes and lets them know what, what she's done without actually, you know, saying, oh, well, I did this. You know, it's more that, you know, well, Lon is writing to Tarmogaidon. Are you going to, you know, will he go alone? You know, I really kind of applaud her Aes Sedaiety for that.
Yeah, as I've said before, I'm not sure how much Lon will, but I imagine he'll get over it. I don't think he can stay mad at her for long, no matter what she does.
I also kind of wonder how long she's been planning this, because it couldn't have been spur of the moment at all. I really have to think that, you know, how did she even find these three Mulciri in this random town, you know, in Saldaea? You know, how did she know that they would be there? You know, how long has she been searching for other Mulciri so that when Lon finally did, you know, express his extreme desire to go and take up his war against the Shadow once again, that, you know, she could say, all right, I'll totally take you and let you do what you want if you give me my the promises I want.
That's pretty sneaky, though, I think. I don't know how long she's been planning it, but it clearly wasn't, you know, as you say, spur of the moment. I have my problems with the whole theme, but still a great moment in Nynaeve history.
Again, a little bit of irony wherein, you know, Rand kind of wonders if someone has learned Ishamael's trick of using the, of tracking Taveren. And then he kind of wonders if maybe it was the blue-eyed man who was able to track him. And of course, the blue-eyed man is Ishamael. He just reborn as Moradin. This does, of course, beg a question as, who did end up sending this particular attack? And, you know, did they use that sort of way of tracking Taveren, or was he found in another way?
Well, they came across a Taveren tracking Taranguil and made use of it, popularly known as the TTT. Just kidding.
It looks like three porcelain cups. There was another note, this one provided to us by Encyclopedia Watt, as noted in many of our previous recapping episodes. A lot of our chapter summaries are loosely based off of the chapter summaries provided by Encyclopedia Watt. One of their notes makes mention that the weave that Olivia uses and that Cod Swain recognizes to disperse the flies is a secret weave which is known, according to New Spring, only to the Blue Aja. So it is curious that they have learned this particular weave. And for some reason, to me, I don't think it's all that uncommon. You know, someone other than Blue Aja at some point had to have found a way to weave a weave that would control insects, or at least shoo them away.
I don't know. Why would they need that weave? It's handy, but do they really need it?
Probably not. The one thing that it made me think of was, Rand is in this room, and suddenly there are all these flies all over the corpses. And it made me think back to the Great Hunt when, you know, he stepped into that one room in which presumably Lanfear had laid a trap for him. And, you know, suddenly the very small, like maybe half a dozen flies, you know, started, you know, multiplying in some pseudo illusory way and were like trapping him and, you know, trying to cover everything and suffocate him. And I wasn't kind of wondering if maybe it wasn't that there were actually that many flies, but that maybe there had been some sort of channeling in that building that Olivia picked up on and dispersed the illusion, and Kotsuane might have, well, Kotsuane with her various Tarangreal would have also noticed that it was an unnatural event, and at least noted how quickly that Olivia has learned to do things like disperse of these unnatural weaves.
Well, it sort of put me in mind of that old movie, The Fly. Help me! Help me! I know, I'm really sick, I'm sorry. In more ways than one. It's a good thing that traveling doesn't work like that. Wouldn't it be awful if they had tragic traveling accidents the way they always had tragic transporter accidents in Star Trek? Nobody ever gets...
True, but if done correctly, Rand could feasibly go through a gateway and come out with his, you know, with his hand back and, you know, his eyesight restored and be a younger version of himself again. He might even not even have the wounds.
I like it. I have a time travel gateway that can fix all that. Another task for Nynaeve the Fabulous.
Open the gateway back in time and chuck his dead corpse through it.
You know, well, that actually, that reminds me that I'd wonder why more people haven't thought of using a convenient gateway to nothingness or, you know, opening the gateway into the, you know, the world between the worlds for skimming. Why, I mean, that seems like a really convenient corpse disposal mechanism to me. I could never understand why Halima drugged those maids' bodies all over the, through the snow and out to the woods to hide them. Why didn't she just open a gateway in her tent to a place where you skim and shove the body off the edge of the ramp, you know? It's gone, falling through eternity, never to be seen again by anybody. Does this mean I'm a criminal mastermind?
Asmodian.
Does this mean I'm a criminal mastermind?
I don't know. I do think that, of course, rules out Halima for having killed Asmodian.
Why was that?
Well, we never found Asmodian's body. I predict that he's falling through nothingness right now.
Forever and ever. Yeah, he might be. I mean, that seems really a logical use to me, unless there's some, you know, physical rule against it that I don't know about, which is very possible, since I know nothing of channeling or traveling or opening gateways or anything else. But that would be the first thing I'd think of. First time I saw one of those Aiel fall off the edge, I was sure. But even then, when they mentioned that, you know, we didn't know what would happen if he fell off, that you'd probably fall forever, I thought, well, that's a really convenient body disposal method. A lot easier than digging.
I wonder what happens if you make a skimming gateway parallel to the ground. Is there a chance that one of those bodies, like the Aiel, could just fall out the other side?
Maybe.
And yeah. What kind of velocity would that body have?
I don't know. I'm sure there's some physics to this. This is one of the reasons... This is one of the many reasons why I wish that Robert Jordan hadn't had to leave us so soon, because he was a physics major, and I'm sure he probably could have explained a lot of this in a very rational manner. But what if you try and open a gateway to, like, the center of the sun? Does the sun implode, or, you know, would it just not work, or what? I mean, that would be sort of like the Stargate opening near a wormhole, you know, bad.
Yeah, or what happens if, you know, you step through the backside of the gateway once it's opened.
Well, they mentioned something about that. Somebody mentioned that was a painful process or something like that. I think it was mentioned when Avienda opened the gateway and she was trying to get out of the way of the arrows, and she went around behind it, and they asked if she could do what she needed to do from the backside of the gateway, and she said as long as she could see, she could, but then it was mentioned you couldn't go through the reverse side of the Bay Gateway, that it was either deadly or painful or something, but I can't remember the exact description. And remember that the Death Gates, they didn't actually drop the Trollocs off into nothingness. They picked the Trollocs up and deposited them somewhere else, another world or somewhere else in this world, but Rand wasn't worried about it because they'd be dead. Well, how inconvenient would that be if somebody opened up, you know, you get up one morning and there's a bunch of dead Trollocs lying in your back garden that's got dumped by a death gate from somewhere, who knows where.
This is going to sound terrible, but I just had this image of a farmer waking up in the morning and going out and opening up the outhouse door, and there's a dead Trolloc sitting in the outhouse.
Yeah, I'm telling you, let the Lord of Chaos rule, baby.
It was just the image of, you know, open the door, dead Trolloc sitting on the toilet, close the door.
Mabel, you'll never guess what I just saw.
There ain't right.
There's something wrong here, Mabel. What if it, like, you know, opened and there was a cow standing where it opened and part of the Trolloc got mingled with the molecules of the cow? I'm telling you, there's all kinds of possibilities for tragic traveling accidents here that have not yet been explored. Now, he conveniently mentioned in Knife of Dreams that if you tried to open a gateway to the exact same place that somebody already had a gateway open, that the gateway you made would be shifted over just far enough that there'd be a hair's breadth between them, but that they would be side by side so that they wouldn't overlap. So obviously there's some sort of, you know, physical mechanics involved in where these things can and cannot open. I think that there's a lot of potential for, you know, random acts of chaos in having gateways available. The next chapter is chapter 21, called Within the Stone, and it opens with Rand's point of view. Rand and his party travel to Steading Shangtai, but all the humans are refused entrance because of the Great Stump. Rand then travels to Tyr with Cadswain, Nynaeve, Min, Olivia, and 6 maidens, including Surendra, who were selected by Nandera. Rand is riding Tidashar. They do not try to hide, because if the Forsaken found him at Lord Algarin's, there is no point. As they ride into the city, they hear a shrill whistle. 2 boys, Calm and Donnie, tell them about the steam wagon from the Academy of Carrion. Mervyn Pohl's invention now travels 100 miles in a day and can pull many wagons. Tyr is very cosmopolitan, with numerous outlanders from every nation. Rand has his usual Taviran effect on the city. Rand also knows Alana is there, though he is not as sharply aware of her since Elaine, Avienda, and Min bonded him. The stone is surrounded by besiegers, so Rand and his party stop at an inn newly renamed the Dragon. The innkeeper, Argando Saranche, tries to redirect them to the 3 moons, but Cadswain badgers him into giving them a room anyway. In the common room, an oddly dressed man is trying to sell silkworms. Rand hears a Shanchen accent, but cannot catch the man before he leaves. The innkeeper takes them to a room with a view of the stone. The room is small for the whole party, and Rand and Luce Theron get claustrophobia. Rand seizes Sidene, and Luce Theron lets him hold it. He is dizzy and nauseated. He sees the face of the man from Shadar Logoth, furious and also looking sick. He feels like they are almost touching. Rand weaves spirit and fire to form a gateway into the heart of the stone. Thinking of Kalendor, Rand recalls from the prophecies that who draws it out shall follow after. He wonders what that means for Narishma, but he is otherwise occupied today. There are 2 defenders of the stone standing guard. Yagan Handar offers to take them to Darlan Cisnera because the corridors have been changing. This means the pattern is loosening and the Dark One is touching the world more than at any time since the War of the Shadow. Rand leaves the party to Darlan's quarters by the bond to Alana. He trusts Alana somewhat because of Min's viewing, but Aes Sedai have their own goals like Nynaeve and Beren. It held for 3,000 years, but now with traveling and blossoms of fires, the stone is obsolete. The maidens wait outside Darlan's quarters while Rand and the others enter. Darlan, Alana, Carolyn Damodred, Astaroth Damara, Wyrmin Saniago, and Ionella Narensalona are there. The women are adopting Min's fashion of coat and breeches. Darlan is still annoyed at Cadswain for holding Caroline and him captive in Carrion. Darlan and Caroline are close to engaged. Rand is angry that Wyrmin and Aniela are there. They were supposed to stay in Carrion. They brought some armsmen who attacked the rebels and set back negotiations quite a bit. The rebels hired every mercenary from the Arryn into the Bay of Remara. Rand shouts at them, and Cadswain spanks him with air. Darlan tried 3 times to bring food into the cities, but the rebels stole it every time. Bera Harkin enters with news. Suneman, Talmeran, and the other High Lords are returning to Tyr from Ilion against Rand's orders. The good news is, in agreement with the rebels, Astanda, Hearn, Dedosian, and Saman has been reached. Shanchen were apparently trying to bribe them. Marana and Rafaela are preparing the documents for seals and signatures. The Tyran lords want their titles back, but they will accept Arlen as steward in Tyr and as king and swear fealty to him. All of Rand's new laws will stay. They will pay for feeding the city for a year. Rand is angry at first, but Catswain reminds him that the agreement meets the requirements that he set and that he should stick to it. Rand agrees. Darlin is incredulous at being named king, because Tyr has not had a king since Morena. Min says she knows what his crown should look like, from one of her viewings. Rand orders Darlin to arrest the Seanchan and then to gather an army. Ashaman will take them to Aradoma to prepare for Tarmon Gaiden. Wyrman and Anaella will go with him. Well, this is kind of a strange chapter. A lot of things going on. One thing that kind of bothered me was that why Rand needed to go to all this trouble to rent a room so that he could travel to the Stone of Tyr. Couldn't he have done that from almost anywhere?
I don't know. I wanted to say it was he wanted to, for some reason, be able to see it, to do it. But you're right. It makes no sense at why he couldn't have just traveled from the manor house.
Yeah. I mean, you don't have to see what you're traveling to. I mean, if nothing else, he could have skimmed to it. I mean, they've done that plenty of times. I just don't get that at all.
I'm not wondering if Rand had wanted possibly to kind of get an idea for what's going on around in local Tyr before actually going directly to the stone. Because, I mean, if he, you know, opened a gateway directly to the stone, then, you know, he doesn't get any view of what's going on out and about in the general area. Ostensibly, it's just so that we could get neat things like seeing the train.
Yeah, but it seems really kind of a large waste of time to me, just to kind of get a sense of what the city's doing. It is neat that we get to see his Protean train, although no tracks yet, because he really does want so badly for his academies to create new inventions, and this one is obviously on the way to being fairly successful.
True. Or there was an interesting note that the man who is very oddly dressed and trying to sell silkworms might turn out to be Sharon. I don't know that we can find evidence for that, because I thought that the Sharons were isolationists.
Well, they are, but it doesn't mean that somebody couldn't have, made a break for it to try and sell things on the outside world to try and make his fortune.
And I also kind of wonder, we had claims, well, actually not more than claims, we had testament that Grendel had actually visited Shara and had picked up, you know, not only, or some of their leaders. I don't wonder if maybe one or more of the Forsaken had picked up these little pets to use as spies or some sort, and therefore it might actually be a Sharon who was about.
Could be. I suspect it was just somebody who was trying to get off on their own way and escape from the walled cities. Forsaken could have had a hand in it, but they don't seem much interested in merchanting, unless they just turned the guy loose on his own and decided to make the best of it. And he's having a hard time convincing anyone that silk doesn't grow on trees. No one believes his worms. Then we get another little incident where Rand sees the face of the man from Shadow Logoth, who we know is Morden, and their feelings are mirroring each other, furious and looking sick, and he feels like they're almost touching again.
Just that weirdness of, you know, what happens when a thread of balefire burns another thread of balefire back as that thread of balefire burns it back through the pattern.
Yeah, it's kind of like time travel. It gives me a headache.
The other thing is, it really gets to me at how often Rand seizes control and he has all of the nobles doing what he says, and then he turns up somewhere later to find out, no, they're not. They're doing exactly whatever the heck they want to.
Yeah, he doesn't keep very good control of any of them. And it seems very likely that Wyrmon is a dark friend. I base that on a number of things, but mostly on the conversation that Erdoman Karienin wrote up to him talking to one of the Ashaman, and he said something about, I'll take no more risk without direct orders from the lips of, and then he's interrupted.
True. I also thought that he was a dark friend based sheerly on the fact that his name is Wyrmon. It sounds sinister.
Well, then Darlin Cisnera must be a dark friend, too. That's pretty sinister sounding.
Yeah, I don't know. That sounds almost too... Oh, Wyrmon just sounds like some kind of sick and evil tree.
I think it's interesting, too, that the first time we ever see Darlin is when Matt is breaking into the stone with his fireworks. He and Julin encounter him in the corridor, and they dispatch him with their quarterstaffs, and Darlin is not the nice guy that he comes across as later He's very arrogant and says, you will be honored to die on the blade of the High Lord Cisnera. And it's just very insulting. And what are these peasants doing here? You know, I guess being in love with Carolyn changed him, right?
Well, she isn't Mordred.
Well, there you go. Case closed.
I also really liked when Rand first saw Carolyn. He immediately, you know, had that moment of shock because apparently she looks enough like Moraine that, you know, for just that split second, it was kind of like, what?
Yes, one of the Moraine flashbacks. What are you going to do when she really appears? And I think she will.
He'll think he's seeing somebody who's dead. And, you know, he'll start, like, his moany list of people, and he'll be chorused by, you know, by Luz Thurin, and Moradin will join in, and they'll do three-part harmony chorus of dead women.
Oh, my God. How much more tedious could we get? He'll probably be so startled to see Moraine that he'll think that she's somebody else disguised as Moraine and balefire her, and then she'll have to go on the list twice.
Or he'll go be so shocked out of his mind that he'll balefire his own foot.
Can you do that?
Jury's still out.
Yeah, I don't know if you can balefire yourself. That's one of those weaves you can't touch yourself with. Actually, I thought it was kind of clever about Darwin. We just mentioned that he tried to bring food into the city three times, but because it was spoiling so fast, he brought in food on the hoof, basically brought in cattle and sheep and stuff like that, because, you know, they don't spoil until they die, at least yet.
Yeah, it was definitely good thinking on his part.
I think you're like a pretty good king.
I thought it was a little kind of campy that, you know, Rand's like, oh, well, I'll make Darlin king. And, you know, Min kind of does, and I know what the crown should look like. Oh, yeah, no kidding. You had a vision. We know this already.
I know. Yeah, we got it already, okay? She's starting to sound a little bit like Nicola Treehill. I can foretell, you know. Want to hear some? Yeah, the magic is definitely wearing off.
I think if there was anything.
The viewings are not nearly as special as they used to be.
See, it's also Wiramon and Sunamon. And honestly, with names like that, you can't help but sit there and think Sauron and Saruman. And it's like, you know.
Bad guys.
At this point, we leave Rand for a little while and move on to Chapter 22, To Make an Anchor Weep. You know, I will admit it's not one of my favorite chapters, but as with anything, you can't like you can't like them all, and you know it very obviously serves a purpose. We begin with Harine's point of view. She and Shallan arrive in Tyr and learn that the meeting of Wave Mistresses is in Ilion. When she sees Zeta's ship, Blue Gull, still in the river, she thinks that Zeta is still in Camelon. They sail to Ilion and find that Zeta has traveled there directly. Harine's bargain with the Kuar Mor has been judged deficient, and for that she is very harshly punished, as Min said she would be. Zeta's bargain with Elaine has been judged very favorably, and she has been elected the new mistress of ships. But Harine still kind of believes that Min's viewing will ultimately win out in the end, and that she will rise to glory. In the early morning, Harine and Shallan, or and their deck mistress, take a boat to the Shanshan vessel in the Ilion harbor, where the first 12 of the Anathan Mir are meeting. There are so many seafolk ships in Ilion that most of them stay out of the harbor, lest the Council of Nine and the steward for the dragon make trouble because they are blocking trade. A cold wind with a very strange odor abruptly blows out of the north and ceases just as quickly. They survived Shadar Logoth and Cadswain, so now they feel that they are ready for anything. The boat reaches the Shanshan ship, and Harine and Shallan climb a rope ladder to board. They're formally greeted by Terrain and Cyril, the sail mistress and windfinder, the other wave mistresses, and their windfinders are already in the great cabin. Lincora, Wallen, Neola, Lassine, and Pilana are openly hostile. Their only friend, Meryl, is welcoming. All of them, of course, are wearing their silk mourning stoles. Kair and Tabriel are still worried over Talon's apparent kidnapping. Zeta and Sheolin arrive. Zeta has brought Emilla, a brown Aja, with her from Camelin. She has come to study the Sea Folk, but of course she has been beaten into submission and used as a teacher, or in the new Sea Folk manner. The man they are awaiting has not yet arrived, but he is apparently coming directly from the Kuramor. Zeta plans to send an ambassador back with him. Terrain enters and announces that the man has arrived. It turns out, of course, that this messenger is Loghain. He travels directly from the dock to the quarter deck, and all of the women are shocked by this event, especially Emilla. He asks, of course, if she serves Elida or Egwene, but Zeta will not let her answer. She says that he's a false dragon and therefore tainted. Loghain says that the taint is now gone thanks to the Creator. Zeta demands to know where the Kuramor is, but Loghain is tight-lipped, saying that it is a secret, not for her to know. The Forsaken, of course, have tried to kill the Dragon Reborn, and therefore it can't be made public knowledge. He will, however, accept Hareen as an ambassador. Hareen, of course, is thoroughly shocked by this, and thinks that Zeta will divorce her husband, Amel, before she would let Hareen be an ambassador again. Loghain brings a demand from the Kuramor to send all of their ships to the Ara-Domon with food supplies from Ilion and Tyr. Bandar Aban apparently is starving. Terrain enters again and runs to Zeta with whispered news. Zeta is horrified and calls for Terrain to bring in Kamel Din Selon Long Eyes, sailmistress of the Darter Wind Racer, who relates the news. Almost 3 weeks ago, according to story time, the Amayar on Tremalkane began requesting passage to the other islands, even Isle Somera, held by the Shanshan. The great hand of the female Choden Call has melted, and the Amayar have taken this as a sign that the time of illusions has ended. Their entire race has committed mass suicide. The Seafolk feel responsible, as the Amayar had requested their protection after the breaking of the world, and they had followed in this tradition. Zeta orders that the fastest ships return to the islands to try to save, you know, any that they are able to, but Loghain countermands the order. The ships are committed to Bandar Aban. He tells them that they can mourn on the march for Tarmon Gaiden.
Well, this is kind of a strange chapter to me. There's a lot of stuff going on, but I'm not sure how it's going to tie into the rest of the story. It seems sort of, not irrelevant, but so different that I'm not sure why this storyline was introduced at this point in time with the Amayar. We've really heard almost nothing of them. And here they are, tragically dying. I don't know.
And I think that's part of my problem with this chapter. We've heard so little about them. I mean, barely a handful of paragraphs through the entire series, that when they die and it's, oh, this is so sad, it's sad enough to make an anchor weep, my response was just, really? Is it? Because I don't know these people, I'm not attached to these people, and cruel as it sounds, I really have a hard time caring.
But they were the ones that made the Seafolk porcelain, there won't be any more now.
No, it just means that the pricing will go up.
That's right. So, you know, like I said, again, your commodities tip for the Fourth Age here is sell Quendiar and buy Seafolk porcelain.
Smash! Oh, price went up.
No. That's not what you do. Now it's a collectible.
You don't do it in your own home.
Oh, you smash other people's Seafolk porcelain. Well, it's so thin, it should be easy to smash. I'm actually more upset about Talon disappearing than I am the Amayar all tragically killing themselves. I mean, that's, you know, how cultish is that? That's definitely, you know, a Hail Bop moment there.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it leads me over to, you know, Hail Bop, Hail Bop, doodle-doo-doo, Hail Bop, Bop-doo, yeah.
I can always count on you to come up with the appropriate song or jingle.
Yeah, if the Amayar were instrumental in some way in Rand's success or failure in the last battle, or anything at all, you know, I'm kind of just hoping at this point that them all dying serves some sort of purpose other than to make the sea folk sad. You know, I will then forgive this chapter for existing, but it does. It seems horribly disconnected. It basically serves to reinforce that Loghain, like myself, really doesn't care as long as the sea folk do what they're supposed to do. And, you know, that's about it. Yeah, it introduces that they, you know, the idea that they still don't really know what the Aes Sedai and the Silver Swan were doing, but that Emilla was probably one of them. So, you know, it keeps in, you know, that sort of purpose is there in check. It gives a little bit of timing chronology as to, you know, when the, you know, the Amayar are apparently committing suicide about 28, 29 days after Rand cleansed the source, which kind of gives you, you know, a focus for when those events happened in relation to the end of Winter's Heart. I mean, it's kind of just, I don't know, it seems horribly disconnected.
Yeah, I have to agree. I'm hoping that we'll find that there was some deeper meaning to this that we just haven't seen yet. But otherwise, I just don't know why he bothered to delineate all this, all these characters just to take them out. It has to have some meaning or purpose, but I confess that it's beyond my figuring out at this point.
I mean, well, I'm trying to remember, there was a bare handful of moments wherein, like, I remember them mentioning the Time of Illusions at one point in time. Someone was like, oh, the Amayar believe that their entire lives are an illusion, and that one day that has to come to an end. And it's like, oh, that's nice. And then it did. So, yay! Good for them.
Yeah,
I guess.
They achieved their goal. As the Time of Illusions is over. I have to say that Loghain came off probably looking more like a lord during this chapter than any other. He certainly, you know, he's adopted his sigil again, and he certainly acts the part of a noble. Other than that, I thought it was kind of interesting. You know, he's so uncaring about the Amayar, which, you know, really they have no attachment or effect on him, and yet he takes the time to be considerate to Amelia, the little brown Aes Sedai, who's so nervous around him and, you know, can't even pour the wine without spilling it and so forth. And he takes time to be nice to her. Well, that's kind of an interesting side of him.
Yeah. I mean, again, Loghain is one of those characters I really like. And if it turns out that he's been turned by the Dark Friend Murdral combo, you know, I'll be a little sad. I kind of hope he hasn't, because all of his wonderful glory will then take on a rather darker note later in the series. But no, it was nice in the couple, or one of the previous chapters, we didn't really mention it because it's a relatively minor point. They do point out that Loghain was a lord. And when he proclaimed himself False Dragon, the king in his respective portion of the world basically stripped him of his lands and titles and took it all away from him. But it's neat to see that. I mean, he wasn't just this random guy who's like, I can channel, I'll call myself the Dragon Reborn. I mean, he came from some place, he had, you know, a varied background, and the man is just amazingly capable, amazingly intelligent, and, you know, honestly, I really like him.
Yeah, I do too. I'll be sad if he's been turned too. It's just a fear that I've had. I don't know. I do think it's interesting. I can't believe how things escape me after reading and rereading these novels so many times. But I suddenly remembered that the blue and gold flaring halo around Loghain is almost exactly the same as the blue and gold flaring halo that Nin saw around Sheriam. and those are two characters that I suspect of having been turned against their will. And they could have glory, power and glory for the Dark One, too.
That's very true. It also brings to mind a listener email that we received from Simon of Brisbane. He writes, "Hello again, everyone. Said I was just reading through the Lord of Chaos and came across something that makes me think I might know something connected to Loghain's glory. Min's viewing of Loghain says that he has a flaring halo around his head, radiant in gold and blue. It shouted of glory and power to come. In the Lord of Chaos, chapter 28, entitled Letters, there is a passage describing how Mazrim Taim looks just after he travels into Rand's apartments in Camelin and kills the Grey Man. It says, Taim strolled in, completely at ease, wearing a black coat with dragons entwined around the sleeves in blue and gold. Given that Taim wears this coat instead of the dragon pin as a symbol that he is the Mihail of the Black Tower, and given that Loghain and Taim clearly dislike each other, my contention is that Loghain will become Mihail and inherit the coat, thus the blue and gold coloring."
That's an interesting theory. I kind of like that.
I also kind of like that, and I have to agree with Simon. I didn't put it together with the colors, but I did definitely think that Loghain's glory is going to come from being the new Mihail, or as I like to think the title will be renamed following the last battle back to Tamerlan, that Loghain will control the new Black Tower once he defeats Taim in his Dreadlord capacity. So I definitely want to thank Simon for that. And, of course, once again, we would like to thank Encyclopedia Watt for the basis of our chapter summaries for this episode.
Absolutely. Encyclopedia Watt, in case you don't know, encyclopediawatt.org is a wonderful resource that I highly recommend to anybody. If you have any questions about any character, any place name, or pretty much anything in the entire Wheel of Time, go to encyclopedia-watt.org. And you will probably find the answer there because it's comprehensive.
Yes, a big thanks to Bob Klutz for that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that will pretty much wrap up our recap for these chapters, 18 through 22. And we're flying through the book as quick as we can, try to get this done before the Gathering Storm is released, so that we'll all be completely up to speed for that exciting event.
So we definitely hope that everyone enjoyed this particular episode. If you have any ideas about things we said, if you can catch any things that we might have missed, if anything we said or didn't say has sparked a crazy theory or even a not-so-crazy theory, there are a number of ways you can get a hold of us to let us know. We accept pretty much everything, you know, general comments, ideas, criticisms, critiques. We definitely love hearing everything that the listening audience has to offer us. A lot of it, of course, goes into making the podcast better for everyone. You can, of course, leave us a voicemail, which very often can lead to you or your voice appearing in a podcast at 1-888-333-7690.
Yes, and we promise that the voicemails that you have left recently will be coming up on an episode. We've sort of done a full court press to get some of the topical issues like Jason's read-through of the Gathering Storm and the interview with him and then this recap of Knife of Dreams. But once we get back on our normal schedule, we're going to have several listener feedback episodes. And again, you can also reach us through email at podcast@dragonmount.com.
In addition, on dragonmount.com, there are both the Fourth Age podcast page, and after each individual episode, there is a comments section where you can comment, and a lot of us actually frequent those comment sections and respond to what is posted there, and generally have some nice and sometimes heated debates with the various people there. You can also find us on the Fourth Age forum page of Dragonmount, which is at www.dragonmount.com/forums.
And you can also reach us through some of the social networking media, such as MySpace, Facebook, and Twitter. On MySpace and Facebook, we have a page for the Fourth Age podcast. Our Twitter username is Fourth Age with no space. And we will be glad to respond to any of your tweets or comments that you might make on Facebook or MySpace.
In addition to the Fourth Age pages, you can also find DragonMount.com on Facebook, and you can follow them as well on Twitter.
And we're always happy to hear from you at any time. We really appreciate your listening. And once again, we want to thank you all for listening, writing in, and some of the great comments that you all left for us. And we hope that you enjoy doing this as much as we do. And so until the next episode, this is Virginia, hoping that the light will illumine you and bring you joy.
And for myself, Andrew Gellos, and everyone here at the Fourth Age, Saravya Ninto Manshima, Tai Shi Tang. Be really interesting shaving with Balefire.
No, I don't think so.
I think you'd permanently get rid of the hair.
And probably your leg and your face and everything else. Started about Tidashar, the magically now stallion again who was a gelding.